this week on Pirate Party Radio. Data retention law struck down in Germany. $15,000 fine for copyrighted downloads proposed in New Zealand. And UK's digital economy bill could outlaw Wi-Fi and block YouTube. This is Pirate Party Radio, episode 18 for Thursday, March 4th, 2010.
When we have the opportunity to give away music, I believe that we should, because music should be shared. You can't charge somebody for enjoying music, you know, not really. Let's not be silly. Who said that musicians have to be millionaires? Who said this? Who made this a rule? We don't need that much money. We just don't. So let's just accept it and let's, you know, see it as something that can be beautiful and it might change music for the better. You know, it might kind of sort the weeds from the flowers, I think.
We are under siege. They are doing everything they can to prevent progress, to prevent the spread of culture, and to prevent privacy as we know it. The only way to stop this is to unite. This is definitely a global movement. It's continuing to spread across the world like wildfire. We are seeing the birth of a new global political power. There's no way to control the information. There's no way to control culture, control knowledge. And those who control culture and knowledge control the world. And that is losing its last control. People don't understand how big this really is.
I'm James O'Brien, and welcome to Pirate Party Radio, the official show of the Pirate Party of Canada and the U.S., your source for news around the world on copyright, net neutrality, open government, free culture and speech, patents, privacy, and more. Make sure you check out the Pirate Party Radio forums for links to all the news stories mentioned during the show. Now, off the top of the show, we had an intro clip from Joss Stone, an artist in the UK, entitled Sorting the Weeds from the Flowers, talking a little bit about copyright and the freedom of music. And let's get right into the pirate news. Copyright news from the UK. Consumers confused by copyright. Consumers are confused by copyright laws that mean it is still illegal to copy a CD onto their computer, a watchdog says. Mind you, this is in the UK. In Canada, that's not quite the same. Consumer Focus said the copyright law was outdated and millions of people were unaware they were breaking laws. But a legal expert has said there was no danger of individual consumers being prosecuted for copying music and films for their own use. Instead, commercial operations are the focus of law enforcement. The current state of the law means it is illegal for somebody to copy a CD or DVD onto a computer or an iPod for their own use. This copying to a different device is known as format shifting. In a poll of 2,026 people, some 73% said that they did not know what they could copy or record. Jill Johnstone of Consumer Focus called for the law to be updated to take the advance of technology into account. The world has moved on and reform of copyright law is inevitable, but it's not going to update itself, she said. However, IT lawyer Nick Locklett of DL Legal said that nobody was being prosecuted for the technical breach in the law. Those who set up commercial operations were more at risk for prosecution, he added. He said a similar issue arose when video recorders allowed people to record a television show and watched it later in the day, which at the time was illegal. An amendment to copyright laws only came after video recorders had been on the market for some time. One argument against allowing people to ship their music or films onto a different format was that the artist could claim that these works only had a limited lifespan, and so people should pay them again for having the work of a different format. Separate proposals to disconnect so-called peer-to-peer file shares have caused concern among internet campaigners. This is when people share music or films even though only one of them has bought the original. A spokesman for the Intellectual Property Office says that a short-term fix on copyright issues was not appropriate. We would welcome EU-wide action to develop a copyrighted system that would bring real benefit to consumers. However, there would need to be fair compensation to creators and rights holders for any new exceptions to copyright, he said. While many European countries do this through imposing a levy on the price of electronic goods, we do not wish to push up the price of computers and MP3 players for cash-strapped consumers. The government has already consulted on a very narrow exception to copyright for format shifting. The response to that consultation suggests that a format shifting exception is insufficient to meet either the consumer or business needs in the digital age. So very interesting. Well, not really surprising that most people are unaware of what they can and cannot do, since there's a sense coming from the industry saying you can't copy anything ever. And the lawmakers are saying, well, yes, technically you're not allowed to, but everybody does it and we turn a blind eye. So why are the laws still on the books? Well, because the lobby groups are pushing hard to keep them on the books. And they say they only go after mass copying. Well, for now, they only go after mass copying. But when the corporations really want to clamp down, they can pull these laws out of the woodwork and go against the average consumer. Copyright news from Europe. Europe will not accept three strikes in ACTA treaty. So good news. Sent in by Weird Wolf. The European Commission has pledged to make sure the ACTA global treaty will not force countries to disconnect people for unlawfully downloading copyrighted music, movies, and other material. The assurance from the Office of the Trade Commissioner, Kirill de Gucht, is the strongest statement on ACTA to emerge from the new commission since it took office earlier in February. We are not supporting and will not accept that an eventual ACTA agreement creates an obligation to disconnect people from the internet because of illegal downloads, John Clancy, DeGucht's spokesman, told ZDNet UK on Thursday. The three strikes rule on graduated response systems are not compulsory in Europe. Different EU countries have different approaches, and we want to keep this flexibility. The ACTA negotiations, which have been taking place since 2007, aim to create a new global intellectual property enforcement regime that builds on the 1994 agreement on trade relation aspects of intellectual property right. Much of ACTA is taken up with trademark protection and counterfeit goods, but the draft text also has a section on online copy protection, according to published summaries. All the countries involved have agreed to keep draft text confidential until the final treaty is agreed. In these secretive circumstances, many people have expressed fears that ACTA will force signatory countries to cut the broadband connections of individuals who download copyrighted music, films, and software. These fears have been stoked by leaked negotiation documents, notably an October 2009 EU commentary on a US proposal. The commentary indicates that the US wanted to account a termination system to be put in place, with civil remedies as well as criminal penalties for copyright infringement. The EU Commission maintains that any criminal action should be for infringement on a large commercial scale only, Clancy said on Thursday. ACTA has never been about pursuing infringements by an individual who has a couple of pirated songs on their music player. For several years, the debate has been about what is commercial scale. EU legislation has left it to each country to define what a commercial scale is, and this flexibility should be kept in ACTA. Clancy also addressed concerns raised on Monday by EU privacy chief Peter Hustigs. Hustigs complained in an official opinion that he's not been consulted on the contents of ACTA. He's also expressed fears that data protection and privacy safeguards were not being built into the treaty from an early stage and called for public debate on the treaty. And this is the real problem about the treaty. It's being negotiated by the large corporations with no public consultation or even government consultation above a couple of key people that are in there. It is not public at all. We don't know what's going on in it, and we can only see through the leaks what is coming out. And it's basically a global enforcement regime to enforce the will of the corporations that hold the media in its hands and be able to take down anything that they don't like, whether it's on the internet or offline, and be able to enforce their will upon the people. And if we can't see what's going on in these ACTA treaties, we can't put in our own what the public wants, what the consumers need, and what balances out, because right now things are out of balance, as shown in that last story. People are confused. They don't know what is legal and what is not, and most people are thinking that what they're doing is legal, and maybe it shouldn't be illegal. Being able to copy and share things amongst yourselves. Like if you bought a book from a bookstore and you're able to give this book to another person and be able to share it with that other person, the same thing is not applied to in the digital age. And things need to catch up. People need to be educated about this stuff. And if these treaties are negotiated in secret, there can be no input from the public. And what the public perceives to be legal things that they do every day. Next story, copyright news from New Zealand. $15,000 penalty for web downloads sent in by Mind Inversion. Anyone caught breaching copyright by downloading films and music from the internet will face large penalties and could even be disconnected by their internet service. Under new legislation, a three-strike system will hand out formal warnings to offenders, and further illegal downloads could prompt copyright owners to apply for up to $15,000 compensation from the user. The copyright owner could also ask the relevant internet service provider to cut off the consumer's internet connection for up to 6 months. The ban could happen only after a copyright owner, such as a media company, applies for a district court order for the internet service provider to suspend the user's internet access. The copyright infringing file sharing amendment bill was introduced to Parliament this week and is a replacement for the last year's controversial proposal that would have banned downloaders from ever having internet connection. The former bill also included no process that allowed internet users to rebut a copyright owner's allegations. Under the new law, however, internet users who feel that they have been wrongly penalized will be able to take their case to the copyright tribunal for free. Bloggers say that even though the new bill is an improvement over the old one, it still shouldn't be passed. Creative Freedom New Zealand Director Bronwyn Holloway-Smith said internet termination was quite extreme. A fine would be an adequate punishment. The internet has become a core, vital service that you wouldn't terminate someone's right to post a letter. That's a three-strike system, but there's a tribunal in place to judge cases. We've yet to see what scale they'll be basing their fines on. We want something proportionate. The focus of protest was Section 92A of Labor's Law, which have put the onus on the ISPs to disconnect copyright infringers. Ms. Holloway-Smith said one flaw in the new bill that anyone disconnected from one internet service will be free to sign up with another. Justice Minister Simon Power stressed that the bill's main purpose is to protect copyright owners from being ripped off by people continuously downloading and sharing files. Online copyright infringement is a problem for everyone, but especially for the creative industry, which has experienced significant declines in revenue as the file sharing has become more prevalent, he said. So, again, the companies are protecting their outdated scheme and their outmoded way of making money in the new digital age, and they're scrambling to try and do anything and taking it to the extreme now of kicking people off a vital service that everybody uses, and especially if the internet is disconnected for a whole household because, say, a parent is the only person in the house that is legally allowed to get internet in the house, and they've got children like 3, 4, 5 years old, and they're disconnected off the internet because of a three strikes rule or any kind of other rule that disallows them from being on the internet. Now the kids are left without internet. It's like being without a telephone or any means of communication, or like they said in the article, being banned from using the mail. It's an integrated thing in our society now. Everybody uses the internet, for a manner of speaking, and people are used at schools are expected that kids are going to have internet at home and be able to do research on the internet. I think the shift has gone away from libraries and more focused on internet research in schools now. So being able to disconnect a whole household from being on the internet is taking a little bit extreme to protect the pocketbooks of musicians. They need to catch up and find new ways of making money. Their old ways are gone. They need to get with the new program and find new streams of revenue. Copyright news from the UK. Open Wi-Fi outlawed by digital economy bill. This is sent in by Weirdwolf, and he says, looks like a new idea is coming across from the United Kingdom that will eventually or nearly very soon block open Wi-Fi internet in that country. Seems someone has the idea that it's not okay to have a free and open internet over Wi-Fi radio. And as you might have read in some other my comments, this is associated with the previous news stories about ACTA and now other countries' idea of In the Name of Children and other MPAA-RIAA ideas. Let you know now, this article had me fuming. And the article is, the government will not exempt universities, libraries, and small businesses providing open Wi-Fi services from its digital economy bill copyright crackdown, according to official advice released earlier this week. This would leave many organizations open to the same penalties for copyright infringement as individual subscribers, potentially including disconnection from the internet, leading legal experts to say it will become impossible for small businesses and the like to offer Wi-Fi access. Lillian Edwards, professor of internet law at Sheffield University, told ZDNet UK on Thursday that the scenario described by the Department for Business, Innovation and Skills in an explanatory document would effectively outlaw open Wi-Fi for small businesses and would leave libraries and universities in an uncertain position. This is going to be a very unfortunate measure for small businesses, particularly in a recession, many of whom use the open free Wi-Fi for effectively as a way to get the punters in, Edwards says. Even if they password protect, they have the two options, to pay somebody like the cloud to manage it for them, or take responsibility themselves for becoming an ISP effectively, and keep records of everyone they assign connections to, which is an impossible burden for a small cafe. In the explanatory document, Lord Young, a minister in the BIS, described common classes of public Wi-Fi access, explained that none of them could be protected. Libraries, he said, could not be exempted because this would send entirely the wrong signal and could lead to fake organizations being set up, claiming an exemption and becoming the hub for copyright infringement. Universities cannot be exempted, Young said, because some universities already have a stringent anti-file sharing rules for their network, and it does not seem sensible to force those universities who already have a system providing very effective action against copyright infringement to abandon it and replace it with an alternative. Young added that universities will need to figure out for themselves whether they qualified as an ISP or a subscriber. This is a distinction that carries very different implications under the terms of the bill, which would establish possible account suspension as a sanction against subscribers who repeatedly break copyright law and force ISPs to store user data and hand it over to the rights holders when ordered to do so. Businesses providing open Wi-Fi networks to customers and clients will also need to decide whether they are ISPs or subscribers, depending on the type of service and nature of the relationship with their consumers. Although it appears unlikely that few or other than the possibility of large hotel chains or conference centers might be ISPs. Now, if you step back from this whole thing and go back 10 or 20 years, and you would ask yourself now, looking at these stories, how did the music and movie industry get so much power that they're able to kick people off essential services? This is music and movies we're talking about. Entertainment. Entertainment for the masses. Able to take people off essential internet services that they use every day. How did this come to be? How did they get so much power? It's all through lobbying and their money talking and taking their money to the government and pretty much bending them to their will. Because this is ridiculous. Being able to make a university liable for their whole subscriber base, having to track what everybody's doing, this is a huge invasion of privacy. And they're able to take down small businesses from providing their subscribers access. They have to take down everybody's name so that they can track what every single person is doing on their connection. Otherwise, they get their service disconnected. It's outrageous. It's gone way too far. And someday soon, people are going to wake up to what is going on and how much control these companies have over you and me and our privacy and what we do with our own connections on the internet. And they're moving more and more towards a new style of internet where it's totally clamped down and it's a garden wall where we all have to beg permission to get information, access to information, because it's being so controlled by the corporations that they've convinced everyone that they're criminals and they're doing wrong. And they have to go to these corporations and beg to be able to talk to their friends over the internet. Copyright news from the UK. Lord's copyright change could block YouTube. This is also related to the digital economy bill. One of the most contentious parts of the controversial digital economy bill was voted down by the House of Lords last night, only to be replaced by a clause that campaigners say is even more draconian. The Liberal Democrats forced through a surprise amendment to the bill's notorious Clause 17 on Wednesday, in a move that dealt a defeat to the government but troubled critics, who suggested that it would have the opposite effect that its creators intended. Instead of sweeping new powers that threaten sweeping alterations to British copyright law, two sweepings in that sentence, not very good, the Liberal Democrats added a clause that would give extra oversight to the High Court. The new proposal, which was passed by the House of Lords 165 votes to 140, gives a High Court judge the right to issue an injunction against a website accused, there it is, of hosting substantial amount of copyright infringing material, potentially forcing the entire site offline. Putting forward the amendment, Liberal Democrat peer Lord Clement Jones said that it would placate concerns over the so-called three strikes rule, which could see those accused of sharing files illegally online having their internet connections cut off, and added that it was a more proportionate, specific, and appropriate way to approach infringement than the previous proposals made by the government. I believe this is going to send a powerful message to our creative industries that we value what they do, and we want to protect what they do, and that we do not believe in censoring the internet. We do not believe in censoring the internet. But we were responding to genuine concerns, he said. But instead of making the proposed system more transparent and accountable, critics said it will simply leave it open to abuse. This would open the door to a massive imbalance of power in favor of large copyright-holding companies. Jim Killock, executive director of the Open Rights Group, individuals and small businesses would be open to massive copyright attacks that would shut them down just by the threat of action. This is exactly how libel law works today, suppressing free speech by the unwarranted threat of legal action. The expense and the threat are enough to create a chilling effect. In particular, there are concerns that the amendment could follow in the footsteps of America's controversial Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which has been accused of encouraging companies to file bogus copyright claims to block material they dislike. The high cost and dangers of dealing with copyright claims in court may mean that many web hosts simply take down the material in question without checking whether the copyright case is legitimate, even going as far as shutting down the entire website in some cases. So this is following exactly in the footsteps of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, being able to shut down or ban websites that are hosting accused copyright infringing materials. And this is seen on YouTube, bloggers' websites that we posted, talked about in the past, where they're talking about music, anything, pictures. It could be anything that is owned or trademarked or copyrighted by any company anywhere. And all it takes is an accusation. And that's the key word in these types of legislation, is the accusation of having copyrighted material. Well, anything that you didn't make up yourself from scratch is copyrighted material in the essence of the law. If you've taken a sentence from somebody else that somebody's written at any time, that is copyrighted inherently. In Canada and the U.S., I'm not sure about other countries. If you take a picture from somebody else's website, now even if you're take a picture and link it to their website, or take somebody's write-up or anything that somebody else has created and put it on your own site. There's even been copyrighted colors from, or trademark colors from companies that use it Like the UPS Brown, or that's an example. I'm not sure if they've copyrighted that, but specific color tones that people have copyrighted. So anything is copyrighted. So unless your site is absolutely 100% uncopy, like have nothing from somebody else's site, you could be taken down from a mere mention and a threat. From these new bills coming through, the digital economy bill is going to be the new DMCA in the UK. Watch out for it. Net neutrality news from the US. NTIA Strickling, we need Internet Policy 3.0, it says, sent in by Mind Inversion. Should the government set policies for regulating the internet? If so, to what extent? During a speech at the Media Institute in Washington this week, Larry Strickling, President Obama's top official at the Department of Commerce and administrator of the National Telecommunications and Information Administration, suggested that there should be a policy discussions between government agencies, foreign governments, and key internet constituencies issues as privacy, child protection, cybersecurity, copyright protection, and internet governance. It's now time to respond to all the social changes being driven by the growth of the internet, Strickling says. We need Internet Policy 3.0. We enter this new decade recognizing that we rely on the internet for essential social purposes, health, energy efficiency, and education. It's also a general engine for economic and social innovation. We must take rules more seriously if we want full participation, but we must keep the need for flexibility in mind. He went on to describe the internet as a large and growing social organization. There are no natural laws to guide it, and there is most certainly no self-regulating equilibrium point because this cacophony of human actors participating in this organization demands that there be rules or laws created to protect our interests, he said. That's human nature. For example, Strickling pointed out that if you're a user, you want to know that you can make a transaction online without your credit card information falling into the wrong hands. If you're a content owner, you want to be allowed to take action against users that infringe your copyright. If you're a small backbone provider, you want rules to govern peering relationships with large providers. If you're a large enterprise, you want your investment protection against hacking and intrusion to be sound. If you're a network owner, you may be against net neutrality rules, but that does not mean that there are not any rules. It just means the network owners get to create their own rules about whether or when to discriminate. Despite the tremendous economic growth and social innovation that has occurred online in the past decade, policy tensions such as these have arisen and not been effectively addressed, Strickling says. Given all the human actors involved in the internet with all the competing interests, we have to ask, do governments have to be involved to sort out these interests so that the internet will continue to thrive? I see yes, but it just as emphatically, I say that the government's role need not to be one of a heavy-handed regulatory. He added that although the NTIA is not a regulatory agency, as the principal advisor to the President on telecommunications information policy, I think we have a role to play in preserving and building trust on the internet. So he proposes a network that can discriminate without losing net neutrality and also regulating the internet so it continues to thrive. Well, the modern internet seems to have thrived just fine for the past 20 or so years without any government interference at all. And it seems very good at self-regulating. It's really good at routing around censorship and government lockdowns, and will continue to do so with or without government interference. So if they start laying down laws, it's just going to be routed around that and be even more difficult to find out what's going on the internet because it'll be driven underground. Now, copyright news from the U.S. Bogus copyright claim silences yet another Larry Lessig YouTube presentation sent in by DC. Nearly a year ago, we wrote about how a YouTube presentation done by a well-known law professor and strong believer in fair use and fixing copyright law, Larry Lessig, has been taken down because his video, in explaining copyright and fair use and other such things, used a snippet of Warner Music song to demonstrate a point. There can be no clear example of fair use, but the video was still taken down. There was some dispute at the time whether or not this was an actual DMCA takedown or merely YouTube's audio-video fingerprinting technology, which the entertainment industry insists can understand fair use and not block it. But in the end, does it really make a difference? A takedown over copyright is a takedown over copyright. Amazingly enough, it appears that the almost exact same thing has happened again. A video of one of Lessig's presentations that he just posted, a chat he had done for the Open Video Alliance a week or so ago about open culture and fair use, has received notice that has been silenced. It hasn't been taken down entirely, but the entire audio track from the 42-minute video is completely gone. All of it. In the comments, some say there'd been notification somewhere that the audio has been disabled because an audio track that has not been authorized by WMG, Warner Music Group, which would be the same company whose copyright caused the issue a year ago, but I haven't heard or seen that particular message anywhere. However, Lessig is now required to fill out a counter notice challenging the takedown while silencing his video in the meantime. While you can still see the video on YouTube without the audio, it's pretty much worthless. Thankfully, the actual video is available elsewhere, where you can both hear and see it. But really, the fact that Lessig has two separate videos, both of which are clearly fair use, neutered due to bogus copyright infringement, risks a serious problem. I'm guessing that once again, this video was likely caught by the fingerprinting rather than the direct claim by Warner Music. In fact, the issue may be identical one, as I believe the problem last year was the Muppets theme, which very, very briefly appeared in this video, as an example of a fair use in action. But it was Warner Music and the others like it that demanded Google such a fingerprinting tool in place, and such companies are talking about requiring such tools under the law. Now, the audio is back up because I guess Lawrence Lessig has been able to argue against this small fair use clip being taken down. And this is an example of not really censorship, but how far the hand reaches on the internet and how automated it is. Now, YouTube is a private corporation. It's not a government censorship, but it shows you how much control now the corporations have over things such as popular sites such as YouTube, and how their farther reach can go, and how much pressure they're putting on ISPs and hosting sites. Now, I've seen something recently called TinEye, and it's been around for a little while, but what it does is picture matching technology. And what I'm predicting in the future that's going to happen is they're going to leverage this kind of picture matching technology and use it in the same way that they're using the fingerprinting technology in the audio of YouTube, and they can apply it to even the video of YouTube and the video and pictures posted on your website. So all they need to do is submit a picture that they have copyright over, and they could shut down your whole website because of one picture, because the ISPs will have to comply with the DMCA notice that'll be sent out. So effectively silencing even things that are critical of them. And by using a picture in something that could be considered fair use because they're talking about it and making reference to it, by using just one small snippet of a picture, even if it's not like the full-blown high-res copy, but a small fair use copy of it. So I predict that in the future of more fingerprinting technology in terms of video, text, and audio comprising the whole realm, and they'll be silencing pretty much almost all the internet of even being critical of anything. Corporations could do it of people talking about reviews of their products and bad reviews, saying that they were not authorized to talk about their product or use a picture of their product or quote anybody about their product. Very chilling effect, as they talk about over and over again when these kinds of stories come up. Now, censorship news from China. Google wants U.S. to weigh WTO challenge to China's censorship. The Obama administration is weighing the merits of taking China's censorship of Google Inc. to the World Trade Organization as an unfair barrier to trade. The U.S. Trade Representative Office is reviewing legal arguments advanced by two groups with links to Google, spokeswoman Carol Guthrie said. The Computer and its Communications Industry Association and the First Amendment Coalition says China restrictions on web access and content discriminate against U.S. internet companies and online commerce. Going to the WTO is well worth considering, Nicole Wong, Deputy General Counsel of Google, operator of most popular internet search site, told reporters after a congressional hearing in Washington yesterday. Using censorship in a manner that favors domestic internet companies goes against basic international trade principles, Wong told lawmakers. Google will stop censoring results as are required by the government in China, the company said January 12th, after it called an infiltration of its technology and email accounts of Chinese human rights activists. The Obama administration sided with Mountain View, California-based Google. Secretary of the State Hillary Clinton said January 20th that China is among countries walling themselves off from progress by restricting web access. We are looking at that, U.S. Trade Representative Ron Kirk said in an interview with Bloomberg Radio on February 23rd, when asked about the proposal to take the case against China to the WTO, the Geneva-based trade arbitrator. It's less of a trade issue than it is a freedom of information issue. Google rose $8.37, or 1.6%, to $541.06 yesterday in the Nasdaq, blah, blah, blah. While going to the WTO would put a spotlight on China's internet policies, it wouldn't likely provide a speedy resolution. Trade disputes before the WTO could take 2 years or more to litigate and appeal. So it's good that somebody like Google, which has deep pocket and large influence, can actually maybe put a spotlight on Google on the censorship that is going on in China. And only through communications can a culture progress. If you wall somebody off from the rest of the world, they're not going to progress. They're going to stay stagnant. And I think it is a great thing that Google can go to bat against censorship, whatever their angle is, even if it's a business angle, at least this can happen. Privacy news from Germany. German court overturns law on phone and email data. Germany's highest court on Tuesday overturned a law that let anti-terror authorities retain data on telephone calls and emails, saying it marked a grave intrusion into personal privacy rights and must be revised. The court ruling was the latest to sharply criticize a major initiative by Chancellor Angela Merkel's government and one of the strongest steps yet defending citizens' right from post-September 11th terrorist fighting measures. The ruling came amid a Europe-wide attempt to set limits on the digital sphere in the name of protecting privacy. That includes disputes with Google Inc. over photographing citizens for their Street View maps and a vote against letting U.S. authorities see European bank transfers to track down terror cells. The Federal Constitutional Court ruled that the law violated Germany's constitutional right to private correspondence and failed to balance privacy rights against the need to provide security. It did not, however, rule out the data retention in principle. The law had ordered that all data, except content, from phone calls and email exchange be retained for 6 months for possible use by criminal authorities who could probe who contacted whom, from where, and for how long. The disputed instructions neither provided a sufficient level of data security, nor sufficiently limited the possible uses of the data, the court said, adding that such retention represents especially grave intrusion. The court said that the fact the citizens did not notice the data was being retained caused a vague and threatening sense of being watched. Well, it's not a vague and threatening sense. They are being watched. They're being recorded. Anyway, nearly 35,000 Germans had appealed to the court to overturn the law, which stems from a 2006 European Union anti-terrorism directive requiring telecommunications and companies to retain phone and data and internet logs for a minimum 6 months in case they're needed for a criminal investigation. Civil rights activists who fiercely oppose the law welcome the ruling. So that is excellent. And I think it hit the nail on the head when he was talking about the sufficient level of data security and sufficiently limited the possible uses of the data. Because, well, it's great that they're hunting down criminals and terrorists and all of that, and that's what they always trot out to invade your privacy and to record everything you say and do. But what happens when this data falls into somebody else's hands or is used for a purpose that it was not originally intended, which happens all the time. You hear about it in the news all the time about websites being hacked into, databases being stolen, computers left on car seats and laptops being taken from cars and data being compromised in those kinds of ways. Now, if data is being collected about every single person and everything they do, and if this data falls into the wrong hands, there can be severe implications from the people who took it, or even if this data is sold to third-party marketing companies and at you're not aware if this is even happening or who has your data after a while. They're trying to make back the dollars that they spent on this stuff by selling off your data, even if they, you know, anonymize it. And there's been studies shown in the past that even anonymized searches can pinpoint down people, where people live and who exactly what their names are. Because especially if you go to Google Maps and people search their own address all the time to be able to map from their home location to a distant location so that they can see how long it takes to get there. And by analyzing, even anonymized, say you take out the name of the person or their any kind of personal data and just have it mapped to, say, an IP address, they can correlate data and be able to map it back to you based on places that you're going, places that you're logging into, usernames that you're typing in, things like that. So this is a great step in the right direction for Germany and hopefully sets a tone for other countries in Europe for privacy protection and data protection. In privacy and free speech news from the EU, sent in by DC, European court set to give public figures chance to gag press on damaging stories. Now, this is a very frightening story. It could spell the end of kiss and tell. Public figures might, within 18 months, have the power to stifle bad news stories before they are published, a senior lawyer has warned. The European Court of Human Rights is currently fast-tracking a landmark case brought by Max Mosley to tighten UK privacy laws. Mark Stevens, a lawyer acting for a group on media and free speech organizations opposing Mr. Mosley in court, believes that this extraordinary pace with which it is proceeding suggests the judges are about to rule in the former Formula One boss's favor. That would mean a change in the law that would force press to contact anyone that they're intending to run a story about to warn them that if it could potentially breach their privacy, giving a public figures a chance to gag newspapers before publication. With rules like those, readers may never have learned about the Sven-Goran Eriksson and then his then-boss Mark Palos having affairs with Ferry Alam, an FA secretary, or Rebecca Liu's alleged fling with David Beckham. Big stories, but Mr. Stevens said these cases generally take 3 or 4 years to reach a conclusion, but this one seems to be moving with much more quickly than that. I've been asked to provide my response to one set of documents sent to me by the court within a matter of days, where normally I would have weeks. It is also my professional judgment that this case was admittedly on a surprisingly fast timetable. It looks more like it could be over in 18 months or so. Mr. Stevens, a partner with the London-based firm Finder Stephen Innocent, pointed out that normally relatively few cases are admitted to court. When they are, he said, it's unusual on the basis that the judges believe that there's something to be debated. However, this case is proceeding more quickly, which suggests that they accept most of Mosley's point. It is on a fast track, he insisted. So, let's see. Mr. Mosley brought the case to the UK last year, claiming that the country's privacy laws were out of step with the European Convention of Human Rights. The High Court awarded him £60,000 in damages on July 2008, ruling that stories about his sex life published in Sunday's newspaper invaded his privacy. Mr. Mosley believed the damages did not go far enough and took his case to ECHR, demanding that, since Article 8 of the Convention protects the right to privacy and family life, the UK be forced to amend its laws. So, in this case, it seems reasonable that somebody not be published about their affairs with other people and who they're sleeping with, because really, who cares? The gossipy tabloid magazines are the only ones who care about that. But the far-reaching effects of this, as it pointed out, is that people will have to be asked before they are published in the newspaper, even public figures. And in some countries, that extends to corporations as well, because they're seen as people. So what, in effect, this could do is that before any story is published in the newspaper, which impacts a person or a corporation, which is pretty much every single news story ever, you'd have to go and ask permission from that company to publish the story about them. And of course, if it's in any kind of negative light, they're going to say, no, that's invading my privacy. And then the newspapers will turn into one cheery story after another of happy news, and all it is just promotion and ads for companies, because that's the only thing they'll allow through. So that does not bode well for the newspapers and reporting and journalism in effect at all. All you're going to get is press releases from companies talking about their newest product, because that's all they're going to allow through. So this is something definitely to watch as it trickles down from the UK and the EU. Copyright news from the US. Ubisoft's Uber DRM cracked within a day. Now, if you remember, I believe I reported on this about the Ubisoft's crackdown on their games and how their games are allowed to be accessed, and the copyright protection, the DRM, they put on their new games. And it said any new games from now on will have to check in at home to the Ubisoft servers to be able to run the game that you purchase. So you need a constant, very, 99% uptime internet connection, or you'll be kicked off the game and not be allowed to save your game, or even allowed to play it if your internet is down, or if you're away from your internet, if you're on the train, or if you're away somewhere, not at home. But this the news story says it's cracked within one day. Last month, the gaming giant Ubisoft announced their new Uber DRM, which required customers be continuously online in order to play purchased games. Of course, this DRM was circumvented in a few hours, and while downplaying this blunder, Ubisoft fails to see that they've only increased piracy. A DRM as an anti-piracy tool, DRM simply does not work, and it never will, although everyone fully realizes this. For example, Ubisoft recently decided to introduce a new solution preventing pirates from playing their games. Their new DRM requires gamers to be online all the time when playing their games. Without an internet connection, the game simply won't work. The new plans were welcomed with skepticism by fellow game developers and a majority of gamers. Instead of hindering piracy, the DRM only restricts legitimate customers from playing the game how and where they want. Most people agreed. I'd also like to add to that privacy as well when you play your game. What is it their information? Why do they need to know when you're playing your game? And you have to ask permission to play their game after you buy it and you've paid your money. It's like, please, can I play this game? No, sorry, our servers are down. Or you've done something wrong. We're going to kick you off from every game you've ever bought from us because you cheated in one game or hacked a game or something. And now you can't play any of our games because we know who you are. A survey among members of the SubSim community regarding the DRM on Silent Hunter 5 shows that, if anything, the new DRM is putting off customers from actually buying the game. Only 15% of the respondents say the DRM wouldn't affect their plans to buy Silent Hunter 5, while 85% say that they would delay or cancel their purchase until a DRM-free version becomes available. From these responses, it would be concluded that many potential customers would prefer to use a DRM-free or pirated copy instead of a legitimate product, which is the opposite of what Ubisoft wanted to accomplish. Silent Hunter 5 was released on Tuesday, and just a few hours later, a cracked version of the game was published on many file-sharing sites. Ubisoft, warning that DRM haters would download the game illegally, quickly responded to the news about the cracked DRM and released a statement which they downplay the issues. You have probably seen rumors on the web that Assassin's Creed 2 and Silent Hunter 5 have been cracked. Please know that this rumor is false. And while a pirated version may seem to be complete at startup, any gamer who downloads and plays a cracked version will find their version is not complete. Ubisoft quickly responded. While many downloaders report the game works just fine, Ubisoft's statements does hold some truth because, in their view, the game is obviously not complete without the DRM. At this point, it is not entirely clear what else could be missing in the cracked version, but that is beside the point. So, another corporation who wants to protect their product is driving people away from their product because the pirated version offers more than the actual legitimately purchased version. So when you go to the store and buy these two games, Assassin's Creed 2 and Silent Hunter 5 from the store, and you put it in your computer and your internet's down, it's going to say, sorry, you can't play the game. But if you download it off the internet and run the game, it and your internet is down, it's totally fine and works perfectly. So who is offering the better product? And who is wasting their money on yet another DRM scheme that has been cracked? All of them have been cracked throughout the ages, all the way back to even the VCR days where it inserted code, the Macrovision, so it made it all warbly and horrible looking and fading in and out on your screen. That was cracked, and all the way up to today, this has been cracked as well and is offering a better version downloading off the internet than if you purchased it in a store. They're going about it the wrong way. Take that money that you're spending on developing the DRM and promoting the DRM and dedicate it to giving something to the people who actually legitimately buy the game. Give them something associated to the game, like a map of the world that they're playing in, or a pendant, or some physical object that they'd want to get with their game and make it more exciting for them. Make it more enticing to buy the actual real game than to download it off the internet and play it. That's who you have to compete with now, is the pirates. You have to compete with the people who are offering things and stripping out the stuff that you put in to make your game worse. They're actually improving your product. You should be paying them to offer your product for a better version, because that's where people are getting it. And you have to take this lesson as well from the people who make, the people who make movies and music have to take this lesson as well. See, the people people are going to the theater still in droves, and they're promoting new products like 3D movies. That's a great, that's an interesting improvement on movies, or maybe not an improvement, but something that generates interest in people going to movies. Look at the revenues of Avatar, the latest huge 3D movie. People are going to it in droves. More than ever before has anybody made more money on a movie than Avatar. That works. So, say musicians go to, when you have your shows, your concerts, offer t-shirts, offer a free copy of the concert after the concert, or even sell it for $5, sell it for $10 on a CD or a memory stick or something. Make it worthwhile. Make your fans love you. Don't make them hate you. Don't make them turn to something else that is not restricted. In copyright news from Canada, Canadian throne speech says government will strengthen copyright, sent in by DC. If you thought the Canadian government will finally at least get at least a clue on copyright after protests, swarming riding seats, and giving very clear signals through copyright consultation, you have another thing coming if you've heard the speech from the throne today. When the Conservative government of Canada held a copyright consultation to gauge what the public wanted in terms of copyright laws, Canadians were very clear about it. A graph from Michael Geis shows where Canadians stand on the issue, and a vast majority are against another Bill C-61, often referred to as the Canadian DMCA, against anti-circumvention laws, are for a stronger fair dealings and stronger protection from liability from non-commercial use. Previously, before the consultation, but shortly after Bill C-61, the speech from the throne, and everyone knew was a signal that the Canadian DMCA was on the way at the time, said, our government will proceed with legislation to modernize Canadian copyright laws and ensure stronger protection for intellectual property. After the copyright consultation, the government says to encourage new ideas and protect the rights of Canadians whose research, development, and artistic creativity contribute to Canada's prosperity, a government will also strengthen laws governing intellectual property and copyright. So the difference? After Canadians made clear what they want in copyright, the government, instead of saying stronger, they say strengthen. In other words, the Canadian government has sent a clear signal that it doesn't care one bit about what Canadians have to say about copyright. They will only listen to foreign corporations intent on destroying Canadians' competitiveness in the global economy today by making copyright stifle a copyright stifle Canadian innovation. Not one thing has changed. We're back to square one. The only thing that has really changed is the government showed Canada the finger on copyright-related issues. The copyright consultation at this point has pretty much been a complete farce at this point. At this point, twice. And copyright news from the U.S. Unintended consequences. 12 years under the DMCA. This is from the EFF.org. And this is kind of a summary of what has happened over the last 12 years with the DMCA, as often referred to when comparing it to other copyright laws that are trying to be put in place in other countries. This document collects reports cases where the anti-circumvention provisions of the DMCA has been invoked not against pirates, but against consumers, scientists, and legitimate competitors. It will be updated from time to time as additional cases come to light. Previous versions remain available. Since they were enacted in 1998, the anti-circumvention provisions of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, codified in Section 1201 of the Copyright Act, have not been used as Congress envisioned. Congress meant to stop copyright infringers from defeating anti-piracy protections added to copyrighted works and to ban the black box devices intended for that purpose. In practice, the anti-circumvention provisions have been used to stifle a wide array of legitimate activities rather than to stop copyright infringement. As a result, the DMCA has developed into a serious threat to several important public policy priorities. First one, DMCA chills free expression and scientific research. Experience with Section 1201 demonstrates that it is being used to stifle free speech and scientific research. The lawsuit against 2600 Magazine, threats against Princeton professor Edward Felton's team of researchers, and prosecution of Russian programmer Dmitry Sklarov have chilled the legitimate activities of journalists, publishers, scientists, students, programmers, and members of the public. Second one, DMCA jeopardizes fair use. By banning all acts of circumvention and all technologies and tools that could be used for circumvention, the DMCA grants to copyright owners the power to unilaterally eliminate public's fair use rights. Already, the movie industry's use of encryption on DVDs have curtailed consumers' ability to make legitimate, personal use copies of movies they have purchased. Third one, DMCA impedes competition and innovation. Rather than focusing on pirates, some have wielded the DMCA to hinder legitimate competitors. For example, the DMCA has been used to block aftermarket competition in laser printer toner cartridges, garage door openers, and computer maintenance services. Similarly, Apple has used the DMCA to tie its iPhone and iPod devices to Apple's own software and services. DMCA interferes with computer intrusion laws. Further, the DMCA has been misused as a general purpose prohibition on computer network access, a task for which it was not designed and to which it's ill-suited. For example, the disgruntled employee used the DMCA against a former contractor for simply connecting to that computer system through a virtual private network. And it goes on listing out lots and lots of examples over time that are very interesting abuses of the DMCA, which it was not originally intended for. This is a great example of pushing through laws where they're mostly whim laws. They're pushed through for one purpose, but used and abused for many, many other purposes. And this is a great list and example that you can go through and look at what could happen in your country if something similar to the DMCA could be enacted. This is a great reference point to refer back to. Now, in Pirate Party news, this website was set up by Pirate Party Switzerland for information about ACTA, and it's called Stop ACTA, and you can get the link on the forum, the Pirate Party Radio forum. And it briefly explains the Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement ACTA is a planned plurilateral trade agreement between 38 nations. According to the participants, the aim is to reduce more efficiently the alleged rise of product piracy. The negotiations are underway since June 2008, and they're currently in their seventh round. The declared target is to sign the agreement as early as possible in 2010. Every single negotiation round was held secretly, without access for the public or even members of the European Parliament, but industry lobbyists, like members of the IPR, have access to the agreement draft. Such methods are not compatible with democratic standards and are leaning towards corruption in the global society. And it goes on explaining more about ACTA. Of course, we've talked a lot about ACTA in the show. And it also links to news stories about ACTA and also as much information has been released from this private document that is being discussed in secret around the world. Now, for my closing words, there's a great auto-scrolling map of the... This is also Pirate Party news, actually. There's a great auto-scrolling map of the pirate parties around the world, and it's little flags, and it scrolls around showing you all the areas where pirate parties have been set up. This was sent in by DC, and you can find the link in the Pirate Party forum. Also, a great write-up, how balanced copyright gives us as many freaky Alice in Wonderland as we can handle. It's a great article on how limited copyrights and public domain enriches our culture, and goes on to talk about all the different versions of Alice in Wonderland that has been able to be created because it's in the public domain, including notoriously Walt Disney, who keeps pushing for longer and longer copyright restrictions in the U.S., but relies on public domain stories to fuel most of their films. And a great article from The Onion, a parody newspaper, entitled Google Responds to Privacy Concerns with Unsettling Specific Apology, sent in by DC. Responding to public... Now, this is fake, keep in mind, but, you know, it's sometimes... the funniest things are closer to the truth than you'd want to admit. Responding to recent public outcries over its handling of private data, search giant Google offered a wide-ranging and eerily well-informed apology to its millions of users Monday. "We would like to extend our deepest apologies to each and every one of you," announced CEO Eric Schmidt, speaking from the company's Googleplex headquarters. "Clearly there have been some privacy concerns as of late, and judging by some of the search terms we've seen, along with tens of thousands of personal email exchanges and Google chat conversations we've carefully examined, it looks as though it might be a while before we regain your trust," added Schmidt. "Whether you're Michael Paulson, who lives at 3425 Longview Terrace and makes $86,400 a year, or Jessica Goldblatt from Linwood, Washington, who also has a well-established trust issues, we at Google would like to say how very truly sorry we are." And it goes on from there. Anybody who's familiar with The Onion will appreciate this story as it relates to privacy and Google. So, remember, if any of these stories have interested you, please check out your local pirate party and to find out more about what you can do to help preserve your rights and freedoms. If you have news stories you'd like to hear on the show, or questions or comments, just head over to thepiratepartyradio.com and submit them through the form on the website. I thank you for listening, and until next time, this has been James O'Brien for Pirate Party Radio.